You're listening to a News Report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
I'm Miles Helfand, editorial director of thebodypro.com. The Affordable Care Act. The name alone is enough to make eyes glaze over for clinicians and patients alike. Yet the impact of the ACA, or Obamacare, as it's colloquially known, has the potential to be massive when it comes to access to clinical care for HIV-positive people in the U.S. And with more ACA-related changes on the horizon, the importance of staying informed has never been greater. That's especially the case for healthcare providers who work in settings supported by Ryan White Care Act funding. So, to discuss the real-world effects of the ACA and offer guidance to HIV healthcare professionals, I spoke by phone with two leading experts, Michael Sagg, a professor of medicine and the director of the Center for AIDS Research at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, as well as a former chair of the HIV Medicine Association, and Michael Wong, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the chairman of Health HIV, an education and advocacy organization for frontline care providers. Let's dive right in with a question that is probably unfairly binary, because this does not seem like the kind of issue that is easy to parse in yes or no terms. But from each of your perspectives, and let's start with you, Dr. Sagg, is the Affordable Care Act ultimately a good thing for HIV patient care, or is it a bad thing?
I think overall it's a good thing. Number one, it will put, generally speaking, more people into insurance plans, be it Medicaid or some other kind of plan, and it creates more options. In essence, there's more money flowing to clinics and flowing to cover the cost of medication, so it'll give some relief to the Ryan White Care Plan, and we'll get back to that, I'm sure, later, but the bottom line is it's a good thing.
Dr. Wong?
I have to agree with Dr. Sagg completely. I think some of the other experiments that other cities and states have been able to do, it's proven to be a really positive approach. I think the devil will be in the details on the transition from our current state of affairs into a full implementation of the Affordable Care Act across the country, though.
We'll get into a little bit of that, I think, shortly. Let's start by, I think, looking back over the past few years since the ACA was first approved and the changes that have been implemented as we've gone on. Can either of you quickly go back over how the ACA has already altered HIV care?
You may want to take that, Michael, because you're in Boston and you guys have been experiencing something similar to it for quite a while now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not for us in Massachusetts. It's not so much ACA. It's actually the state's been ahead of the healthcare reform game by probably about 5 to 7 years, and we've had essentially almost complete universal healthcare coverage by insurance, either a combination state federal type of insurance or private insurance now for I believe it's over 5.5 or 6 years. And that portion of the coverage has been helpful, but taking a step back a little bit, even before this started, I think there were some fortunate decisions that were made both legislatively and through our Department of Public Health prior to our foray into healthcare reform and healthcare payment reform, where certain conditions were actually recognized as being sort of high-cost, high-profile conditions, and existing payment schemes, including safety net schemes, weren't going to be quite sufficient to cover the population that was projected to exist. So some of the things that Massachusetts did early on was recognize HIV as a chronic condition and put it into the state Medicaid program. So it became covered under state Medicaid, and this is probably a good 7 or 8 years before healthcare reform was even discussed in the state. And by doing that, it actually opened the opportunity, as Dr. Sagg was referring to, for patients, particularly those who were economically or medically disenfranchised, to actually have coverage and have the opportunity to enter into care. And at the same time, the state started investing fully into the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, and actually, rather than calling it an ADAP, because of the inclusion of HIV into the state Medicaid program, they actually called it HDAP, the HIV Drug Assistance Program, and very quickly evolved to the point where they used that money and leveraged that money to help pay for insurance premiums and insurance copays. So rather than just drugs, it actually managed access to care portion and had the medications paid out of the plans that the patients enrolled in. And by doing this, they really kind of amplified the ability for that money to go far. Then we had moved into our equivalent of the Affordable Care Act, or first insurance coverage, now payment reform. And in doing this, it's been really impressive in terms of how we've been able to keep patients in care, actually reach out farther and engage patients and get them into care. So I think in the states that have been able to roll out their insurance programs, look at their payment coverage schemes, and create the programs that allow their insurances to be very portable, but also look at what they really want to include in terms of those key important medical conditions with associated programs that need to be covered, those states are actually going to be moving ahead very nicely and probably encounter relatively little pain in the process. I think the ones that are smaller states or have not been able to tackle this in any real big picture vision are really going to be the ones that are going to have some problems trying to implement. And it's really trying to help bring those states along in a way that allows them to have more reasonable care across the board for their HIV-infected population and their marginalized healthcare population as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, if I were in charge, I would model a system after Massachusetts' experience. Oh, wait, that's what the Affordable Care Act is. I mean, it's so true that Massachusetts has been a great sort of standard-bearer model for actually the actual basis of the Affordable Care Act. And the success that's been there has just been continued. So I think if we could depoliticize somehow this whole implementation of the Affordable Care Act, I think everybody would be better off. That probably will never happen. But I think even as recently as this week, more and more states are kind of waking up to the benefits of having the federal government help underwrite the cost of adding these additional people onto the Medicaid rolls to whatever it is, 133% of poverty, some states 100%. But the point is that delta, that difference between what they're currently paying for through their state coffers, in our case it's about 20% of federal poverty, we could get that additional 80% of people into the system. Why is that a bad thing, especially with the federal government paying for it? So I think if we can just sort of wake up and depoliticize this a little bit, I think we could really go a long way to helping people who really need the help.
Yeah, well, and you're saying this in the context of your practice in Alabama, where I believe the last word was that the governor did not want to expand Medicaid with the Affordable Care Act because the money wasn't there.
Yeah, that was one of it. And then later the shift was to, well, we didn't have the right infrastructure within Medicaid. And actually, that's a true statement. And so that the last legislative session here, not to get too much into the weeds in Alabama, but I think it does speak to a lot of other states, Medicaid was revamped structurally so that now I think it is in a position or will be in a position to participate with the ACA. So hopefully other states will act and ultimately come around. But, you know, if we think back to the implementation of Medicare in the 60s, there was probably equal resistance to implementation in several states. And ultimately, folks came around because they saw the benefit of it and stripped away the politics more and more. Hopefully that'll happen here.
I'm sitting here silently nodding my head up and down.
I saw that.
Dr. Sag, have you seen in the interim an impact on HIV care in that area? Have you seen more people getting into care? Have you seen the quality of care improve?
Actually, I can't say that I have yet because it's been kind of slow. The types of things that have been implemented so far are very incremental, such as increasing the coverage of people's children to age 26, that type of thing. Frankly, our basic health care to HIV patients in the state of Alabama is mostly carried by the Ryan White Care Act, and there are several, I think up to 8 or 9 Part C clinics very nicely distributed across the state, and we get some support from our Part B money that is beyond ADAP to help these clinics support. There's also a few community health centers that are participating, but it's mostly the Ryan White Care Clinic, so there hasn't been a lot of change yet. That said, over the next, I think, 2 to 3 years, there will be some changes, and I think that'll play out. One other thing I forgot to mention about one of the benefits is that, and it segues nicely from this last comment, is that all of the patients who are seen outpatient in the Ryan White Care Clinics, that's working okay. But when those patients need hospitalization, the Ryan White Care Act does not cover that. And that's where Medicaid coverage will help enormously. And frankly, one of the leverage points to the states, ultimately, is this notion that it's expected that the states will implement the Medicaid expansion, and therefore the disproportionate payment to certain hospitals for taking care of a large number of indigents will be ratcheted down. And that's part of the way that the Affordable Care Act pays for itself. For places like Birmingham, and I'm sure there are several other hospitals around the country, especially in the Southeast, who are really dependent on disproportionate share funding to their hospitals, that will start going away. It's been delayed now because the implementation has been a little slower, but ultimately that's the leverage point. And so I can promise you that the state of Alabama cannot afford, for example, UAB Hospital to go out of business. And not saying they for sure would without disproportionate share, but we take care of a lot of indigent patients. And the biggest difference, I think, that the Affordable Care Act brings to the table for HIV and for all types of care to indigent patients is hospitalization coverage.
I couldn't agree with Dr. Sag more on that, too. We've had Chapter 224 payment reform bill went through a couple of years ago. Some of our safety net hospitals had real concerns that they were actually going to go bankrupt. And some of these are big institutions that are well known across the country. And fortunately, with reform in, as he had mentioned, the indigent care population that previously were what we referred to in the state as free care, if they got either into the state or the federal government insurance programs or actually managed to get into some of these private-public partnership insurance programs, it offset a lot of the free care dollars. Those actually ended up getting freed up. The payments to the hospitals continued, and they haven't closed.
Then looking on to, I guess, the near horizon, Dr. Sag, we've got a number of provisions in the ACA that are due to take effect over the next several months. How does that change the game?
Again, I think for us in Alabama, I think it's going to not be terribly impactful, but let's look down the road a little further. I think the lessons learned from contrasting, say, Massachusetts versus California, not to get, again, into too much detail, but the bottom line is that I think Massachusetts, because they were ahead of the game, understood how to integrate the payments coming to them through the Affordable Care Act equivalent and through Medicaid, et cetera, was nicely managed by their health department and whoever else was in charge of distribution of finance in the state. And they anticipated changes and they got ahead of it. California has been a little bit more chaotic, not because of anybody's particular fault, but I don't think it was carefully thought out at the beginning about how the Ryan White Care Act funding dollars would interact with people now coming into insurance coverage. And I think the take-home point from all of this is that as each state moves forward on the HIV front, that there needs to be really good coordination between the state Medicaid office and the, in case public health departments or the Ryan White clinics, to easily transition or smoothly transition the folks from, say, indigent status to insured status, and to make sure that the Ryan White Care Act dollars are filling gaps in coverage that otherwise won't be covered. And I think that's what's happened. Michael, you may want to comment about how you guys have done that successfully in Massachusetts.
You know, I think for us, a lot of it has to do with truly just sort of the integration of the key players at the table. the medical director for our state Medicaid program speaks with the Bureau Chief of Infectious Diseases at DPH, and who oversees the Division of HIV and AIDS, and the Ryan White office sits right in CMS's office. So it's very nicely integrated. And that really started a good 10, 12 years ago. Our state legislatures have been working out the roadmap for this process. They've just made a very good point of making sure that all of this was well integrated, that there was the appropriate councils and committees were actually in place before they actually tried to push through any big reform process, so things would be as seamless as possible.
As your everyday HIV care provider then looks to the future and sees large policy changes that ideally result in new patients transitioning to care and new policies in place with how you have to arrange reimbursement and the level of care you're providing to patients. And does a provider just need to hope that there is good leadership at the top? Is it just a matter of sitting there and praying that your clinic is going to be able to make the transition properly? Or are there things that a clinician, that any care provider can do to prepare, to educate, and to get involved?
I think that's a great question. I would say, at a minimum, each provider needs to keep their eyes and ears open for what's happening in their state and to continue their usual practices of screening, asking questions to patients as they come in on each visit about what their insurance status is and adjusting based on them picking up new coverage. That's the minimum. But I think for those who have time, and I would advocate that people do commit some time to becoming involved, to make sure that their voice is heard at the table. And each state, each clinic knows who their state movers and shakers are with regard to making decisions, to get involved and to understand this and to be brought up to speed as much as possible on not only what the Affordable Care Act is going to be doing in its staging of implementation, but understanding how it works in their state. The more that we are involved as providers in these decisions, the easier it'll be for us. And let me kind of make this other comment. The thing I hear most among especially Part C Ryan White providers is the concern that Ryan White funding will go away as the Affordable Care Act is implemented. And you can do the math and see that without the Ryan White Care Act, if everybody had Medicaid, or Medicare for that matter, and you collected 100% of what you're owed, there's still going to be a tremendous shortfall to cover all the services that are provided typically in the average Ryan White clinics. And I can tell you from multiple conversations with people at HRSA and HHS, Ryan White is not going away. What's going to happen, though, is there's going to be a change in what it's going to be covering as more people come on to care. If you can just imagine, let's say just medications, for example, there likely will be much less of a demand for ADAP, at least funding for ADAP, not because they're trying to keep people from getting access to drugs, but rather Medicaid will be covering much more of the cost of drugs. And what I'm hoping is that if some of that money is no longer allocated for Part B ADAP, some of it could be redirected to pay for those services that assure testing, linkage to care, retention in care, psychological services, counseling, substance use, et cetera, that all those the very vital services that keep people in care are continue to be made available. I don't have a lot of concern that those dollars to support that type of activity are going away.
Dr. Wong?
I totally agree. As far as the point of keeping your eyes open and your ears open and becoming as involved as possible in this in some of the state decisions, I think really that turns out to be a really key issue and something that helps definitely lead to success. I mean, most of our legislators really, well, everything to some degree is when it gets to the press is politicized one way or another. Most of them actually do want to hear from their constituents one way or another. And here in this state and when I was in Virginia as well, I really found the legislators were very interested in hearing from physicians groups, nursing groups as well, as long as the message that we were bringing to them was something that was really data-driven, educational, clearly streamlined. They have limited time as well, and with some reasonable leave-behinds. And that kind of advocacy that's not politically bent advocacy is something that I think a lot of legislators really appreciate.
There's one other thing that I think providers also need to do, and I think we alluded to this earlier, but there is this term that's called an essential community provider. That applies to anyone who is a Ryan White medical provider. So we are automatically eligible for that, but we have to let people know that we are essential medical providers by the law. And that makes us eligible to participate in all types of health plans as essential community providers. That will open up the door for a lot of opportunities for all the clinics. The second thing I think we need to make sure that we do is, as we're participating in these discussions at the state level or whatever it might be, I think it's very important that we ensure that the health benefit package for HIV meet the HIV standard of care. I think that was one of the things that got a little bit off balance in California's transition. And again, this notion of integrating the HIV providers with models of care delivery, that's very important.
Is there any risk that what that standard of care is going to change as the ACA evolves and as funding potentially shifts around in the healthcare community as a whole?
I don't know. I can't predict the future about what the ACA is going to be specifically implementing in terms of things. But again, that gets back to the point of that we have pretty good standards of care for HIV patients. Most people who are doing HIV care, especially through Ryan White programs, know those well. And I think keeping our eye on that and matching what those requirements are, what those standards are, to what is being covered by the Affordable Care Act is very important. Now, where we identify a gap, where we see, well, the Affordable Care Act is covering this, but they're not covering something else, then the Ryan White Care Program becomes, as this term's used a lot, the payer of last resort. And in that case, we are totally free to apply those dollars that we get through Ryan White to cover those services. I mean, some of those examples might be maybe some home health care that isn't covered, or some nutrition therapy, hospice services, or palliative care, medical case management for treatment adherence, those types of things, or oral health care is not an essential health benefit of the Affordable Care Act, but they are, I think, very important standards of care for most Ryan White care clinics. So we just need to keep our eye on that and just, and again, not stick our head in the sand and let this change pass us by and then find out later that something is not being covered or there's some chaos going on around us because we didn't keep up.
Does this speak to the importance of a greater development of comprehensive care centers as opposed to specialized care?
That's a really good point, because I think most Ryan White care centers, you might call them specialized care, but in fact, it's pretty comprehensive. And so I think what most providers that I'm talking to want is to more or less continue the outstanding care we're able to provide now. Like, everybody, for the most part, is very proud of the level of care and service that they give to their HIV patients. And I think it, in the really high-functioning clinics, the proportion of patients with viral loads less than 50 copies is somewhere over 75 to 80%, sometimes 90%. Well, that's outstanding. That's what we want everywhere. That not only helps the patients, obviously, it helps with public health as well. So whatever we've figured out, we need to continue to do, and it's kind of up to us to keep track of all this new terminology and all this implementation as we move forward.
Yeah. I think a lot of the implementation that's going to happen really has to be on the ground and in specific for the communities in which the physicians or the clinics are working. I agree with what Dr. Sugg said about the existing Ryan White or HIV clinics. They may be viewed as being subspecialty care, but at the same time, they really are very comprehensive with multidisciplinary approaches within those clinics, and in some ways might actually be good models for some of the medical approaches to medical homes. But that said, you know, even as these medical home models or ACOs or whatever the newer terms are that are being used today or developed more fully, those are all unique experiments that are being done within specific settings, which may be medical or may be economic, and whichever ones end up succeeding will be the ones that become the model for that area or for that state. And within that, we do have a number of physicians who are very adept at what they need to do, others who are learning through programs, just good, strong educational programs that help get them their initial foot on the ground, but still keep the linkages to experts in the field, the HIV experts in the field, the Hep C experts in the field, who can, and within their own network that will allow for this continued standard of care that we're all expecting to continue.
In a way, this is a deeply empowering statement, because what you're saying is that there is not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach here, and there's not going to be one thing that works for everybody, and it's going to be, and this puts the power
no,
with...
You know, when you read ACA, it's really, or at least the newer interpretations and versions, it's pretty clear they're looking for ways to allow states and allow individual jurisdictions to kind of create what works best for them.
Yeah, really speaks to the importance of self-education and self-advocacy here that you guys had both referred to earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I think we should leave it at that. Any closing thoughts from either of you, Dr. Sag?
Well, I think this is a real opportunity, just like we were just now saying. But what it requires is effort on the part of all of us to, number one, learn at least the basics of what the Affordable Care Act is going to provide, understand how our individual states are embracing these changes or how they're planning to implement them or not for now, and advocate within our states for the programs that will work best for our clinics. One thing that HIV providers have that a lot of other primary care providers don't is an organization of sorts where we have been at this for a while, and also really good outcomes through years of experience of delivering high-quality HIV care. We have a lot to bring to the table, and it's up to us to make that happen.
Dr. Wong?
I couldn't have said that better.
All right, then. Thank you both deeply for this conversation.
This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.